Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for a nice introduction. We'll just continue the love fest for a minute. Whatever residual biases I had about Rinzai Zen tradition being like a hardcore, very intense, unforgiving tradition have fallen by the wayside over the last few years. Since we're actually in a Jewish synagogue, I can say it's great that the Rinzai priest and teacher I know best is just an ordinary shamil like me. I'm not Jewish, but my teacher is, so I learned a little bit of Yiddish. It's also kind of great singing a Christian song with the Buddhist congregation in a Jewish synagogue. So there's so many ways we're learning from each other. You know? When you're saying about cultural differences, I thought maybe a bigger cultural difference between North Carolina and California than between American Rinzai Zen and American Soto Zen. You know? So if you hang around in Zen places very much, you know, you hear somehow about sort of non-duality, you know, and sort of emptiness, and it isn't really the way we think it is, but we're not going to tell you the way it really is. It's up for you to discover. So I think I've been thinking a lot about this sort of idea of duality, of dividing things up, that seems to be baked into our language and seems to be in our minds, probably. It seems to be majorly on display in the national stage lately. So divided, right? We've been talking and hearing a lot about how divided we are as a culture and community. So since this came up so strongly, of course it's been there forever, but since it's been more strongly present for us, I've been trying to think about, well, what can we offer? You know, what can we, from the Zen lineages, offer that would actually be helpful, besides like, we'll see you in 4 years or 100 years or something, we're just going to do our thing quietly. And have faith that just being quiet helps, which is, I think, is a good idea too. But if we were to be more engaged and showing up for the conversation, well, what do we have to offer from the Zen tradition? So I've been thinking about the idea of being able to hold both ends of the spectrum, both sides of anything in our hearts and in our minds as a great offering from our sort of meditation practice and our teachings. So this morning I want to share with you three different sort of takes, three different sort of snippets on the idea of duality and non-duality or holding opposites. Is this working? Is everyone hearing me okay?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good. Okay, good. Good. I'll try to keep my voice up. I mean, I've noticed people in our train sometimes, the voice kind of falls away a little bit. It happens, you know. So let me know. So the first of the three musings I want to share is a little essay I wrote for our emailed newsletter called Holding Opposites. And here's the piece. One of the most powerful ideas I've learned from the mindfulness and compassion training of Zen that I've done over the years has been really helpful to me lately. The idea of holding opposites. The idea is that our minds are strongly conditioned to divide things into two opposite possibilities and then try to decide which one is the correct option. It's good or it's bad. I like it or I don't. It's black or it's white. Conservative or liberal. And it seems to be really hard for us to accept in a meaningful way that both extremes may have some validity and some value. That maybe both sides could be right in some way. But when I wrote right on the essay, I had to put in quotes because there's the whole problem all over again. You know? Right and wrong. It could be both right and wrong. Right can be wrong and wrong can be right. And so the mind divides things. It's built into our language. We wouldn't be able to have meaningful conversations without opposites, without divisions. But does our habitual use of divided language and divided thinking divide us up in a way that's not really that helpful? A little too rigid. And that the mind can do this. The mind can deeply accept and allow that apparent opposites can coexist together, that we can develop a mind that's more inclusive and more flexible, and that this could really help us to be present in a way that will knit our communities back together, I think. Certainly helps us personally. We can be much more present for the joys and the sorrows of our life without narrowing and limiting and suppressing and numbing out. If we can learn to hold opposites, that things can be both good and bad, black and white, happy and sad. I think learning to hold opposites is supported by three key qualities in our practice. I made up this list of three, but our tradition is so full of lists that you can make up your own. My three qualities, at least when I wrote this, were willingness, honesty, and kindness. If we're willing, you know, if we're willing to show up, if we're willing to practice, and especially if we're willing to be truly honest with ourselves and look within, we may be surprised that we're full of all kinds of divisiveness and all kinds of opposites and all kinds of narrowness. It shows up in our mind pretty constantly. People show up for meditation at the beginning. I'm sure you've had this experience and seen it in others. And they think, oh, this will be nice. This will help me calm down a little bit, be a little more peaceful. But then you sit down for however many minutes that was, 25 minutes? That's your tradition. Mm-hmm. You say, oh my God, 25 minutes of broiling confusion much of the time. So we have to be willing to look and willing to be honest. And I think willing to be more honest, not just internally, but in our conversations with each other. We have a wonderful and terrible social world to smooth away and create a certain kind of harmony, but it involves a certain amount of dishonesty too, doesn't it? How are you? I'm fine. Not really, but that would be too complicated to talk about. Do you really want to know? No, just making contact, you know. So willingness and honesty. And then kindness. Nothing good comes out of meanness. We know this through and through. But to bring kindness forward as a practice and as a discipline is maybe part of what we can offer from the Buddhist tradition, from the Zen traditions. So if we're willing to be truly honest and look within, and allow all that to be true, this is also a great act of kindness for ourselves, and it ripples out to everybody. We can really accept with kindness our narrowness, our prejudice, our limited views. Then we see that the opposite is true also. Our great patience, compassion, and openness. So anyway, we apply holding opposites first to ourselves, I think. On the one hand, we do have it together. We're competent, skilled, and whole, we're a good person. Of course, we have an inner critic who may be arguing otherwise, but basically we're all right. We're doing fine. We're smart, we're strong, we're kind. People are really glad to see us, and many people depend on us and are worthy, and we are worthy of their trust. So that's true. But on the other hand, we're not. Excuse me. We're confused. We're self-centered. We have trouble getting up in the morning. Life is baffling and complex and unbelievable. We're full of self-doubt and doubt about the world. Maybe we're deeply a fraud after all. And they're finally going to notice. We are, every one of us, suffering. Suffering in some deep ways, too. We have our fears and our doubts. Life is tough, and we're really not sure if this is going to work out. So you can feel, you know, feel when I say those words, right? Yeah, that's true, too. Darn. But could it really be that both are true? And like equally true, fully true. We're doing fine, and we're a mess. My experience is yes. If I don't accept both sides of me, then there's nothing, you know, there's nothing, right? Nothing but churning and confusion, defensiveness, and so on. So we're both, we're good and we're bad. And the honesty piece is to be willing to show and reveal this, these two sides. And then there's the world. So when I wrote this, it was right after the attack in Manhattan. Remember that with the rented truck? The guy ran over people on their bikes. So that was like, you know, several disasters ago already. If I write this today, I would probably be thinking about economic injustice and inequality also. But anyway, I'll just stick with the piece and then we can talk later. So, and then there's the world. I don't know for sure if the world is better or worse than it once was. But lately, so many people I speak with are so worried about the world. It seems to be broiling in chaos. And by the way, there are also impressive sounding statistics and studies suggesting that the world is actually better than it ever was. Less poverty and less violence on the whole. So go figure. Holding opposites can't be avoided. But the world we perceive seems to be really in trouble. And I'm thinking here of our world in the wake of yet another terrorist-style attack on innocent people just going about their lives. How is it even possible that someone could rent the truck from Home Depot that's supposed to be for driving your lumber home for your little home repair project that you're going to have trouble finishing? Instead of doing that, go ram into people riding their bikes on a beautiful fall day. And to set out to rent this truck in order to kill people and maim people and ruin lives. How is that possible? So of course our minds want to avoid thinking about these things, which is natural. What a horrible thing. And I avoided the news from Manhattan for a while, but then I decided it's time to face this, time to read up on it. I was deeply saddened when I did that to learn that five of those killed in the Manhattan attack were half of a larger group of guys visiting New York City from Argentina for their 30th high school reunion. There's a picture of them in the airport back home, smiling and vital and together. They look like such nice people. Kind and warm, happy to be together. Maybe a little proud of themselves for pulling off this trip together. After all these years, you know, go on a big trip. What fun that is. For a moment, reading this, I felt jealous of their friendship and their commitment to each other. You know, my high school friends and I don't have that together. And then of course, the other shoe dropped in my mind, and I realized what had happened. And a vast wave of sadness washed over me, a group of people racked by tragedy. Half of this group of friends, now dead. Five families grieving, and circle upon circle of friends and colleagues and acquaintances and children and parents and cousins, plunged into mourning and loss. How is this possible? In a world that also has babies in it. A friend of mine had twins recently. Unbelievable, man. Wow. And has beautiful sunsets and kind strangers. People stopping to help. How is this kind of thing possible in a world where people sing songs and write poems? The mind searches for an explanation. Perhaps we can wall off the horrible things in a mental box we call evil or mental illness or terrorism. But what do any of these designations really mean? And can they really hold the horrific and protect us from it? Our minds so want things to be only one way. We want to be happy and not suffer. And when there's great suffering, we think impossible that there ever could be happiness again. But our practice, our Zazen practice, our community practice, our mindfulness practice, helps us a lot here. Why? Because it helps us find the space. The space in which both can be true. We can learn to do both, to hold both tenderly and clearly without turning away. We can mourn deeply and feel the pain and great loss and suffering and confusion without being completely overwhelmed. We can even be curious about the roots and the causes of violence and suffering. And at the very same time, we can still be able to nurture our goodness and people, nurture our goodness as people and as a species. We can still feel joy and connection and delight and hopefulness. So to be mindful is to accept what is. Here it is. But what I'm saying is, the is of it is broader and more mysterious and both-sided. The is of it is so vast, you know. And so our practice helps us to be with all of it. And to be compassionate. Compassion arising from the wisdom of our practice. To be compassionate is to meet all of this with kindness. When it's wonderful, when it's horrible. When it seems sensible, when it seems nonsensical. This is our world. This is our world. And little by little, through this practice and through offering this way of being, through modeling and sharing this open-heartedness and this acceptance, this honesty and this willingness and this kindness, may we nurture the good. So I suggest that our practice of opening our mind and holding opposites is essential, an essential offering for us and for the world. And without this, there isn't much hope at all. That's my little essay. Not too cheerful. And cheerful. Second piece I want to share. Hopefully I won't go on too long. I understand the kids have like sort of a fuse that goes off. Oh, I'm already over.
In just about 5 minutes.
5 minutes? All right, I'll skip the second piece and share with you the third piece, and I'll leave that for the next visit. Leave them laughing, right? Or leave them hoping for more. Second piece I want to share is a poem. Poem by a Dainin Katagiri Roshi, who's a Soto Zen priest and now died in 91, I think, who was invited to America by Shinryu Suzuki Roshi, you know, who wrote Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Mm-hmm. Seen both of them in my school of my lineage. So this is a poem that Katagiri wrote. It was discovered posthumously, actually. He never shared it with anybody. And has since become a real favorite of people who knew him. And another lineage connection, by the way, is Jeff Kelly, you know, who leads some stuff with Koshin and is in our group. He's in Katagiri. Katagiri Roshi is Jeff's teacher's teacher. So here's what Katagiri wrote. Being told that it's impossible, one believes in despair. Is that so? Being told that it is possible, one believes in excitement. That's right. But whichever is chosen, it does not fit the heart neatly. Being asked, what is unfitting? I don't know what it is, but my heart knows somehow. I feel an irresistible desire to know what a mystery a human is. Ask of this mystery, clarifying, knowing how to live, knowing how to walk with people, demonstrating and teaching. This is the Buddha. From my human eyes, I feel it's really impossible to become Buddha. But this I, regarding what the Buddha does, vows to practice, to aspire, to be resolute, and tells myself, yes, I will. Just practice, right here now, and achieve continuity, endlessly, forever. This is living in vow. Vow, V-O-W, vow. Herein is one's peaceful life found. So maybe I'll just do it again in chunks and make a few comments, and then we can, and then I'll shush up, and for a few minutes we can have a conversation. So he opens with, although the title of this poem is My Peaceful Life, My Peaceful Life. So he opens it. Being told this is impossible, being told that it is impossible, one believes in despair. Is that so? Being told that it is possible, one believes in excitement. That's right. Whichever is chosen, it does not fit one's heart neatly. So our life and practice is definitely impossible, right? Impossible. So it's subtle and deep. Always more to it, we're always a little bit off, we always have a partial understanding, we'll never get this right. We're never going to, you know that we're never going to finish our to-do list, right? So, it can invoke a little despair, right? Oh man, it's impossible. Practice is impossible, life is impossible, relationships are definitely impossible, no question about it, right? So we can get a little down, like, oh no. But being told that it's possible, one believes in excitement. That's right. Oh yeah, it's simple. Just be present. Just breathe. Just show up. Trust, you know. Trust each other. Some of things work out. Just be yourself. Suzuki Roshi said at one point, when you are you, Zen is Zen. Okay. No problem. Then it says, whichever is chosen, it does not fit one's heart neatly. So it's not exactly impossible or possible, is it? Not to lean too much on one or the other. Rest on the side of the impossible, get lost in the impossible, we suffer, we're stuck, we get depressed, we lash out, maybe we do violent things, I don't know. Hang out too much on the side of everything's possible and simple, we're narrow and miss it, right? Miss the depth of this life. He says, I don't know what it is. So honest, right? I don't know what it is. Advanced Zen master here. I don't know what it is. But my heart knows somehow. I feel an irresistible desire to know what a mystery human is. So what drives us? Why are you here today? What are your intentions? Could you put them into words? In the early days, I go off to a sesshin, you know, and I come home. My wife practiced a little bit with me, but she wasn't going to go to a sesshin. And she'd ask me how it was, and, you know, what do you say? I end up landing on, it was hard and it was good. You know? And then the next time she'd say, hard and good? Yep. She could skip that conversation, which I preferred. So it's a mystery, right? This being human, you know. As to this mystery, clarifying, knowing how to live, knowing how to walk with people, demonstrating and teaching, this is the Buddha. I've always been so touched by this line, knowing how to walk with people. That's my goal, I think. I don't think I really want to know how to teach people or straighten anybody out, but I would really like to know better how to walk with people, how to just be side by side, to be human together on this confusing path. Last part. From my human eyes, I feel it's really impossible to become a Buddha. But this I, capital I in quotes, this I, regarding what the Buddha does, vows to practice, to aspire, to be resolute, tells myself, yes, I will. Just practice, right here, now, and achieve continuity, endlessly, forever. This is living in vow. Herein is one's peaceful life found. So, of course, from our human frame, we can't really know what Buddha is, by definition. It's great about religion. You can just define something, and then that's what it is. Yeah. But there's a feeling to it, right? You know, there's a feeling in the practice when you feel somehow close to Buddha. Maybe your neighbor's close to God, you know. What is that? But it's bigger than whatever you think it is. Impossible to know. And yet there's something to this. And it's endless. It's an endless thing. Endlessly deep, endlessly growing, endlessly feeling into the whole range, feeling the whole width of the cloth. That's one of the great things about Zen, you know. Probably Zen groups will never be like mega churches, because you can feel from the beginning, when you first walk in the door, right? Wow, this is like a big thing, you know. This must take many lifetimes to get the sense of. And I'm sure you get the same feedback we get, that, oh, you're so welcome, that's so nice. But I think that, like, subconsciously people are like, wow, but yeah, I don't know. Only if you are hardy or foolhardy, depending on which it is, foolhardy or hardy, or opposites, people stick around. Because when you touch this, you realize I've somehow tasked myself with a huge responsibility to get to the bottom of this human life. Right? That was the Buddha's question. How do I get to the bottom of this? So what I'm trying to suggest today, this morning, is in our patient effort to get to the bottom of it, we're learning something really important, really fundamental. Maybe we can't put words to it exactly. That we ought to figure out how to share with the world and with each other and continue investigating. Because it can't keep going on like this, can it? You know, so divided. Only one side is right. So let's support this world in seeing that both sides are right and both sides are wrong. And we need to keep going. Let's keep going. So.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.